Don't fucking play with me.
Don't fucking do it.
Don't fucking put your hands on me.
Don't fucking do it.
Huh?
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 Welcome to Gay Talk 2.0, the ultimate podcast for your dose of dish. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Gay Talk 2.0, an LGBT podcast streaming live on Digital Stream Radio, where you can listen live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can access that live stream by visiting digitalstreamradio.com. Today, we're going to be welcoming Bill Prickett. He is the author of A Double-Minded Man, which chronicles the struggle of being religious, gay conversion therapy, and so much more. He's going to join us on the second half of the show. My name is Tom, and as always, I'm your host, and I'm here with my amazing co-host, starting with the first one.
Oh, damn it, I muted it.
Hey, y'all, Nick or Trish.
And
good to be with you guys. It's Chris.
And welcome you all to
the slap.
Don't fucking put your hands on me.
Don't fucking do it.
Welcome to the dish, everyone. All right, so we started off with that opener. That, of course, has been the slap that's been heard all over the world. It was a young gay man in school who was being bullied, and he had enough.
He had enough.
He literally slapped that young boy into the next life.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinarily, I would not advocate for violence, right? Because it's typically not the way to go about things. But in Trump's America, and when you're being bullied and being gay, sometimes it is necessary. And that video gives me life because it just shows that you can, you know, in some way, shape, or form, defend yourself. I, as a young man in high school, growing up in urban New Haven, Connecticut, had to resort to sometimes violence to defend myself from people that were trying to hurt me. And so I certainly understand where the young man comes from. But it's been up in the air about how people feel about it, right? Watching it back and seeing what transpires. So I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So, Chris, when you see that video, aside from laughing hysterically, what do you feel?
Well, I also do not condone violence, and I also am studying to become an educator. So my first thought was, where the hell is the teacher? Later, mm-hmm. you do hear him speaking up. But the kid had the right to defend himself and to stand up to this bully, and he gave him plenty of warning. Plenty of warning.
He did say.
Said, call it again. Call me that again. And he called him that again, and then he went cross-eyed for good now.
Should I play it again?
I just think that young man hopefully learned a lesson.
Yeah. Well, I listen, that boy, that smack was so hard. I don't think that the bully is going to be calling anyone a faggot anytime soon.
But I definitely think we're going to make a soundbite out of that.
Yeah.
Oops. Absolutely.
I mean, like, every time we've wanted to be like, you're an asshole, now it's just...
Because that was a meaty slap.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yes it was. I mean, if the kid, I'm surprised he's maybe he's deaf.
I was waiting to see blood dripping from that ear.
He like fell sideways.
Yeah.
And like, here's the thing, right? So I don't necessarily condone violence, but it's like we need to fucking stand up for mm-hmm. ourselves every once in a while. And this moment for this kid, even though. The fuck was the teacher? It's like you're taking control of the narrative. You're like, fuck off. No, don't. I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. Don't treat me like this anymore. And you're right. That motherfucker warned him. He's like, say it again. Say it again.
Mm-hmm. He had plenty of warning.
And then he did. And then the poor straight dude was like, oh, my God, my ego. And I'm like, because now that's not only like viral, but like. Everybody in your school knows about it, but now everybody else does too.
Everyone around the world. I mean, and then the young kid has been he's been going to interviews, right? We've got news organizations that are interviewing the kid and talking about his experiences. And the one thing that stands out for me is the pent up anger, right? Of constantly being bullied, not being able to stand up to yourself, and finally getting to that point in where you're cornered and you're like, you know what? It's go big or go home.
That's fight or flight right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that for a lot of LGBT youth, LGBTQ youth, I think that, you know, we get to that point often. And for some, that outlet is an opportunity to just let it all out and just put it behind you and move on. But for some who don't get that opportunity to find a slap way of letting it out or a healthy way of letting it out, whether that's talking to someone, it could lead to suicide, you know, not being able to manifest your feelings that you have inside physically or emotionally or verbally can lead to internalize self-hate and end up being, you know, something that we don't want it to end up being. And I think that, you know, it's, again, I don't advocate for violence, but watching that video gave me some sort of joy in a weird way that I was just like, good for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, 100%.
Have either of you heard any of the interviews that he's taken part of?
I have not had an opportunity because I've been so busy at work that, and not that I watch videos at work or anything, but, you know, I've just been so busy. And then when I get out of work, it's like, mom is here and she's been taking a lot of my time. But
because I wonder if this was like a recurring issue. Like if this kid, I'm sure he probably went through some bullying, but I wonder if this particular individual was a constant bully to him and eventually he just had enough of it.
Probably was.
Yeah, no, he definitely, I saw part of an interview with him and this was not like an isolated incident. Mm-hmm. It's been ongoing for him. I mean, and in the interview, the mom, when the person asked the mother, she was like, she started crying. She's like, I'm just so sick and tired of seeing him hurt and hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, like,
And the thing is, you know, that with bullying, it's so touch and go, right? Because you have some schools that are really good about addressing it and bringing parents in and talking and sort of kind of working things out. But then you have other schools that really don't have a really good way of making sure that it stops. And so bullying continues and you have educators that sit on the sidelines and watch it happen mm-hmm. and do nothing.
I mean, it's in each administration, the first lady really devotes her time to at least one specific cause. So we know where I'm going with
yes,
this.
Yes, okay. Let's go.
Yes. So Melania,
uh-huh.
She was going to do everything in her power to end cyberbullying. Yeah.
So
let's just think about that for a second.
So I want to give a little context to the slap. So he came out in the seventh grade, and he's been constantly bullied since. Mm-hmm. Where this came from is that individual that got slapped deserved it and should be slapped again. But so this individual made an anti-gay post with a picture of him on it mm-hmm. saying how he hated gays and put a bunch of throwing up emojis all over it. And so somebody screenshotted it and sent it to him. And what this individual did, what's his name? Hold on. Jordan. He approached him. He said, you know, why did you post this? And then, you know, that's where we ended up.
Oh, that's what it led to?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he has every right to ask. I mean, if you're taking a picture of me and you're trying to use it as a means to ridicule an entire community, but specifically me to my colleagues, my classmates, and my community, oh, you best be known I'm going to be all up in your face and be like, what the fuck is this? Like, seriously.
I'm like, part of me is like, if Jordan actually does this right, he could be the face of a movement.
Yeah.
And a really positive one because, like, yeah, violence is bad, but he stood up for himself
mm-hmm.
and he stood up and believed in who he is as an individual.
That's right.
I'm a gay man and I'm not going to back down from this. And if you have a problem with it,
there you go.
But like, honestly, though, like he could really be the face of a new movement in high schools around America.
Yeah, this can manifest into something much larger.
Yeah. And that's not me saying go out there and slap a bunch of people. No, but that's me saying stand up right. for yourself.
Let's smack it out. That's all. We have an issue. Let's smack it out. You stand in front of me. I stand in front of you. And, you know.
But like the reality, we've been shamed our entire lives. Right. We've been put down our entire lives. How, I mean, how long do we have to remain silent before we can embrace who we are? And that's what he did. He's like, I'm not going to be fucking quiet anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. And that is what is so empowering about what he did, is he stood up and said, I'm not going to be quiet anymore. Why did you post this?
And there you go. I don't think we need a soundbite anymore.
I'm just like, those fucking earbuds flying out of his head. I'm like, why did you post this?
There goes the Apple AirPods. Out the door. Now you got to go buy another one. And they're like $79 each. Yeah. Should have smacked the other one out too. But anyway, let's move on because we've got some other things and there's a lot going on. Chick-fil-A made an announcement today. Did y'all see it? They announced that they were going to no longer support anti-LGBT organizations or donate money to them. And I have feelings. I have a lot of feelings about this. First and foremost, too late, way too late. Fuck you, Chick-fil-A. And here's the thing. They're still a religious organization, so although they may not be on the face donating money to organizations that support anti-LGBTQ agendas, they're still a religious organization. They still have their feelings about the LGBT community, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're no longer homophobic. So that's something that you need to, swallow while you're chewing that what is believed to be amazing chicken sandwich. And I'm just like, whatever. So what do you think about that? Does this make you want to go to Chick-fil-A and get a chicken sandwich?
I mean, no. But like at the same time, you said like it's too late. I would say it's never too late.
Right.
I mean,
to make the right choice, but I think as an institution, as a gay man, I still don't feel like supporting them, because at the end of the day, we know the reason this is going on is because they have been kicked off of school campuses. Mm-hmm. They've been not allowed in airports, and their franchises are getting pushed out of a lot of places. So, yeah, I think it's a financial situation for them.
I think
also when their competitor,
driven by money.
And also if their competitor is
capitalizing on the fact that, you know,
exactly,
they're being homophobic and we're not, and hey, we have a chicken sandwich too.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, that's the thing about watching some of these corporations, you know, try to get that LGBTQ dollar, because as much as the president would like to sit there and say, oh no, we're going to roll back, you know, rights for LGBTQ folks, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these businesses are going out of their way to prove to the American people that they're not about that, right? They want to support the LGBTQ community. You've seen it with a lot of corporations like Delta, and, you know, they're very big presences. They have very big presence in our parades and try to donate money to organizations that help our LGBTQ youth. But when you look at, for example, Popeyes, when they went out and said, hey, listen, we got a chicken sandwich too, and anybody can come into our stores, It just validates the fact that I'm a human, right? And that I have an opportunity to make a choice and not support someone who's anti-LGBTQ and then go to another organization that does support the community.
Right. But also, too, like when you're talking about corporations and whatnot, I think a lot of it, like, there are a lot of corporations that aren't necessarily and haven't necessarily donated to anti-LGBT causes that do give money for, yes, the LGBTQ dollar and support. But I think that's very different from comparing it to a Chick-fil-A who did donate money to, anti-LGBT groups, and now is changing their tone.
Absolutely.
But this is an organization that is known to be a religious-based organization.
Right, of course. They were, according to their tax forms, they were shown to make contributions to the Salvation Army, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and the Paul Anderson Youth Home in Atlanta, which as recently as 2017, this youth home called homosexuality, quote, evil and caused by sexual, physical, and mental abuse of children. This is up to 2017. Some people were still believing this stuff. Now, I still have no interest in stepping foot in a Chick-fil-A. I have no interest in trying their food. But I think Nick got it right. It's never too late to make the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to leave a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths that they went so long and contributed so much money to these people that want us to be people of the LGBT community shot in the back of the head to forgive their, like, to be forgiven for being gay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just think, though, it's driven by the fact that they're losing money.
Absolutely.
And not so much by the fact that they had an epiphany and said, God, we've got...
Well, that's the point of a boycott. That is the point of a boycott.
We've gotten this wrong for so long.
But that's also amazing, though, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it ties into the slap. It's like when people stand up and say what they believe in and they boycott something and they're not being allowed into schools and they're not being allowed into airports, that's because of our community.
Yeah, that's
right. Because there are people that support our community. And the more this movement moves forward, the more companies you're going to see having to change their tone.
Right, because even, and it has to do a lot with the people in our community and then our allies, like you said, people who support our community. Because even people at the restaurant I work at, they talk about Chick-fil-A, and I'm like, oh, I don't go to Chick-fil-A. And they're like, oh, yeah, I know, they hate gay people. And I'm like, yeah, so this is a company that openly hates me, and you still go there? Like, I don't go down there, like, dig down their throats and say, you can't go to a Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
I would just hope that they would care enough about people in their lives that they're not going to put money in the pockets of these people. Who's then going to put it in the bigger pockets of companies and organizations that hate us?
And listen, there's a lot of information that's out there. It is public knowledge of what they have done, what they have supported. And all we ask as humans is for you to really analyze and see the information that's out there and make a decision for yourself and maybe choose an alternative like Popeye's chicken sandwich, you know, if that's what you're really looking for. But then again, that's me. Like you, Chris, I don't foresee that I will ever be stepping into a Chick-fil-A when I have options. Mm. You know, I can cook at home, make myself a banging ass chicken sandwich.
Your mom
with
lives here
adobo.
Now, so.
Actually, she doesn't. She got her own place.
Well, I mean, like,
yeah,
but
or I can go to mom's house and eat. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had some. I wanted to piggyback on what Chris was saying about. So I'm in a leadership program, and there's about 18 of us in the program, and we had a presenter. It's a 6-month program. We have different like installments of whatever, and we had an all-day retreat last week, and we had a presenter, and somehow, I can't remember exactly what it was, but they brought up Chick-fil-A, and of course, the one gay guy in the room was like, nobody in this room eats at Chick-fil-A, and I look around the room, and they all just start laughing. It's like 9:30 in the morning, and I'm just like, oh, God, I'm in a leadership program, but this hot mess is just making everybody look like just laugh. Like, honestly, it's like, you look around the room, and there's all these... like business professionals, people that work for the city and like really like established corporate people. And then there's this
trash.
Me. And I'm like, hell no, this bitch did not just say Chick-fil-A. Like what?
Like, she eats glitter for breakfast. So, I mean, yeah, we get it.
Literally one of my cohort members, well, she was like, you know, the moment I knew I was going to really like you. And I was like, what? She's like, the moment you came out and told everybody that some people call you Trish, because you were like, no holds barred. You just came out. And I was like, honey, I've been out since 16. Of course I'm going to come out.
Listen, yeah, it's the moment you tell everybody that you know, you're called Trish, that's it. It's game over.
But it's interesting, too, though, if you think about it, because she said something to me. That she was like, you know what? You just like, you came at it head on. You know, thing that came out of your mouth was you letting everybody know you were gay. And I'm like,
listen,
yeah. And like, to me, I'm like, you already knew, like,
address the elephant in the room, let it all out. And you know what? I'm not saying you're the elephant in that sense.
I was like, oh.
Wait, I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, right. Ah! Exactly.
I called her an elephant. She smacked me. No, but it's true. You know, you walk into a room, let people know who you are. And you know what? They have a choice. They deal with you on a human level, or you can go fuck yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's my philosophy. And that's how I operate anytime I'm engaging with anyone, you know. And you do you. I'm going to do me 100%. Always. And so that's all we have to say about Chick-fil-A.
I'm sure it's not, but...
Yeah, yeah, I know. Christopher.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of stays on the same page when enough people stand up to hatred that we can win in the end. This past weekend, on Saturday, there was a far-right group that organized Boston Straight Pride in August, and this one took place this Saturday in Dallas. Now, this Straight Pride event attracted 3 supporters. Yes. Three people, so we need two more smacks. There you go. All right. Yes. So the march was hosted by anti-LGBTQ group called Protecting Our Next Generations, or PONG.
From what?
Well, they say they promised the event would include discussions on abortion and how it is murder, marriage values, one man and one woman, and genders. There are only two. So this is what they were advocating for. But like I said, it only reached out to three people, two of which were from Boston. Who vowed that they would send their supporters there. Two people went there, and then one person from Dallas. Yeah.
Now, your supporters.
And the thing that was interesting about this was it was an activist who was saying how she couldn't stop laughing when she saw how low the turnout was. It was activist Soraya Coley, and she had a quote that I really liked, and it was, quote, "It would have been pathetic if it weren't so laughable. They really believe anti-fascists are out there throwing bricks and beating up Trump supporters. Instead, it was LGBT allies with rubber chickens and cowbells to drown them out." So it was a peaceful protest. This now Antifa definitely has
not if Jordan was there.
Oh yeah, no. One for each.
What yeah, for you?
But that is what true. So many people who look at people who are anti-fascist or they believe that they're the violent people who participate in some of the Antifa, they were pretty much like riots, but they're going around just yelling, you know, never Trump, and just hating people just because they voted for Donald Trump. But no, they're going there to drown out their hatred.
Oh my God. Speaking of never Trumpers, like Trump is trying to coin that phrase now for anyone that is testifying against him with all these diplomats and people that are becoming part of the impeachment proceedings. And it's so funny to see someone take someone who's been in a career for 40 plus years, served countless presidents, both Republican and Democrat, and then start labeling them never Trumpers. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whoa, this man is fucking crazy.
Absolutely.
He's freaking crazy. I mean, when we think about, is it Marie Yovanovitch?
Mm-hmm.
She was in the middle of testifying, literally just doing her thing, and this man literally tweeted while she was testifying, and Adam Schiff stopped the proceeding and said, "I need to read you something, and you tell me what you feel, what this makes you feel." And she was like, "This is complete intimidation."
Yeah, which is against the law.
I was just like, "Holy shit, man, this man is crazy."
That's just the charges are going to keep adding, piling up. Now they're wondering, did he lie to Special Counsel Robert Mueller?
And that right
there is another crime. So
to Congress, look at what's his name? Roger Stone just got charged on all seven counts. One of them being lying to Congress.
He's going to go to jail. Just like Michael Cohen, all these people, those cronies who were close to Trump, everything's starting to come out into the open. And as every person is brought to court and found guilty, Trump tries to distance himself from them, just like Sonderlin, the ambassador to the European Union, who is doing all this work. Meanwhile, Ukraine is not even part of the EU. What is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union doing with work in Ukraine? He's being Trump's dirty man. Trump said he barely knows the guy. They've had phone conversations.
Yeah.
Things are starting to get exposed, and Trump's trying to distance himself.
So here's the thing. So he came on, he went, and he had this private deposition in closed-door session, and he said, no, you know, I'm not doing this. It's just not what it seems. And then all of these other officials started coming out and also testifying in closed doors. And now that we have the public impeachment hearings, they are also coming out and saying, yeah, he was part of it. He literally came out and changed his
story. He did. He's like, oh, yeah, I forgot.
Yeah.
I forgot I know that fat ass.
I didn't recall.
Yeah.
Bitch. You're going now.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see all this play out, because what we're not realizing is, I would probably say since Nixon, we haven't seen an impeachment proceeding of this magnitude run this quickly, right? Because even the Bill Clinton impeachments, when we talk about what he did, I mean, the man got a blowjob, lied about it, and got impeached in the House for it.
Mm-hmm. This is the first public televised impeachment proceeding. This is why this process is historic.
Yeah, it's incredibly riveting to see all this happening.
And transparent. The Democrats are making it available to the public.
Yeah.
This is as transparent as Congress can get.
And it's crazy.
It's still not going to go through the Senate, but...
You're right. You know,
as it stands now, absolutely. Stands now. If it is proven that he had committed some of these crimes...
He has!
I know, but they... if it really comes out written in stone...
Do it, Nick. Do
if it comes out and it's written in stone, there are Republicans who are going to end up defecting from him. Because their party is... What these Republican senators are doing... They're killing the Republican Party. At least had respect for dirty conservatives. Now they're just, they've pandered. They put all their values aside and they follow this fat ass who doesn't give a shit about democracy. The Republicans need to think this shit through. I thought 2016 was going to defeat the Republican Party. They're killing themselves since the day Trump took office.
I mean, and and Nick makes a really good point. There is, no matter what happens in the House, just like with Bill Clinton, right. If you don't have a Senate that will convict the man, he will most likely live out the rest of his term and could potentially go on and be reelected for another 4 years. And if the Department of Justice, the idea of a sitting president not being able to be indicted still stands after all of this, even though a couple of courts have said that, you're fucking crazy, that's not going to work. There's a possibility that this man could be in office for another 4 years, and he's doing it. He's making sure that he gets elected to avoid being criminally charged when he's no longer president. Mm-hmm.
And I believe to meet the threshold in the Senate, I believe it's 23 Republicans would have to defect to convict, to reach that 2/3 majority vote in the Senate to convict. 23 Republicans.
I think it's possible, though.
It's possible, but it's a real long stretch because they need to, if it comes out proven that Donald Trump obstructed justice and broke many other laws, there won't be any way that these Republicans couldn't convict.
Well, we shall see. Things are currently playing out in Congress. We're seeing it all play out in real time. We're seeing all these depositions go through, even through the weekend, which is unheard of.
Right. It is also showing that his clout is not as strong as it used to be.
Yeah.
Two red states with their gubernatorial races went to the Democrats.
I love that word.
I do, too. Any chance I can use it, I use it. I love it. But it really goes. I mean, the one that just took place yesterday in Louisiana. Was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday in Louisiana, the runoff or special election. It was a nail biter. The Democrat was the incumbent and won. But in Kentucky, the Democrat defeated the incumbent Republican governor. And then, as we talked about in North Virginia, which both houses.
He didn't even want to concede, but that's a different story,
right, exactly.
Story for another
and
day.
And then it was Virginia, correct?
That it was Virginia where the governor does not want to concede. And we had one Democratic governor literally beat him by a hair.
Mm-hmm. But it was in the Virginia where the both chambers of Congress flipped Democrat, or is that North Carolina?
No, that's Virginia. I'm sorry.
Virginia, yeah.
I confused my election results. It was Virginia, the House and the Senate both went Democrat.
And the governorship, I believe, is also held by a Democrat.
That's right.
So and it goes...
They're completely held by Democrats.
Right. And it just goes to show that Donald Trump spent two different rallies in the past 10 days in Louisiana, and it wasn't enough. Yep. It's showing that his clout is really diminishing.
That's right.
I mean, he was defeated in the midterm elections. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, also think that people that didn't vote are like, fuck.
We got to vote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that is changing as well.
Which is important because they were seeing record numbers of people going out to vote.
Yeah, that's right.
And the scary part is, I mean, this past midterm election, we had record numbers finally going out. But the average... is abysmal. Mm-hmm. What people. So I think you're right, Nick. I think that is going to make a big difference, especially in 2020.
Well, I think it's important too, though, because like Connecticut went so purple during the 2016 election, and I think it's because a lot of Democrats or a lot of people that are liberal that could vote either way depending on what they feel is necessary.
Well, liberal wouldn't be either way, then, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, if you're moderate,
exactly. Yeah.
Like, and you're like, oh, well, we're going to go Democrat, whatever. That's how I felt. I'm like, I'm voting because I should be voting, but like, I'm like, well, we're going to be Democrat either way. But we were deep purple. Like, Connecticut, we need to get out there and vote. It's important.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I can say
if Connecticut ever went red, I'd move.
Absolutely. I saw one.
I can't move. I own a house.
One Hillary Clinton sign in Connecticut for 2016. I saw one. I couldn't count on the population's fingers how many Donald Trump signs I saw in Connecticut, especially the hometown I'm from, the tobacco area of Connecticut, all diehard Trump for president people.
And I really do think, I think it's complacency. I think people are like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about it here.
Right, because too many people were like, she's going to win, she's going to win, she's going to win.
Yeah.
And that's basically what the problem was. Well, listen, boys. Lovely conversation. We can pick it up after our interview with our guests. We do need to take a break because we have a guest coming on and we don't want to be late. So here's some music. We will be right back. So baby,
baby, oh, your love, let's be good. It's hard to see you with a man you call your friend, but in the end, I know I don't have much time to tell you why I wanna die, but then I cry, so then I lie, so I don't make you bend time. Cause if you wanted me to move, you know I would, because I'm good at making you love me. And if I said
ladies and gentlemen, welcome back from the break. That was Time by Pat Riley, a previous guest of ours, amazing song writer and singer. He's just amazing. And I just love that song. It just makes me feel all melodic and smooth and all good inside. But anyway, that's a topic for another day.
Sounds like you're describing a porn.
You never know.
or all right. A dildo. I don't know. Figure it out.
eventually. All right, well, guys, welcome back from the break. Again, joining us now is, of course, Bill Prickett. He is our guest tonight. He's the author of A Double-Minded Man, a book that takes us on a journey of through being, you know, being gay, being religious, and conflicted. There's a lot to unpack here, so we're super excited to have him on the show to talk about this book and tell us what, you know, what drove him to write it. Given the context of the book, I feel that there's a lot of personal inflection built into this book and experience. Mm-hmm. And so I'm super excited. So anyway, Bill, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Greetings from Texas.
Oh, Texas. Ooh. Everything's bigger in Texas. Hi. So I'm Nick, by the way.
And I'm Tom.
And I'm Chris.
Hey, Chris. Tom. Hi, guys.
And once again, thank you for joining us. You wrote this this book, which really takes us on a roller coaster ride through some of the things that a lot of people in our gay community go through on a daily basis, including the controversial conversion therapy we talk about. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we can move into what the book is about and all of that good stuff.
Okay. I am retired. My husband and I live in Irving, Texas, just outside of Dallas, with our skittish rescue mutt, Brody. And before that, I worked for about 20 years in public relations and communications, primarily for nonprofits and charities. But prior to that, my checkered past includes more than 25 years in the ministry. I was a pastor of a Southern Baptist church. I was educated in a Southern Baptist college and seminary. And along the way, because of my conservative Christian faith, I knew that there were feelings inside me that I couldn't embrace. So I got involved with what we called back then ex-gay ministries. They now call it conversion therapy because that sounds so much more technical and official and real, but it's not. And ultimately became involved in that for about 8 years. Was actually the executive director, became the executive director of an ex-gay ministry, spoke all over the country, radio, television, giving my testimony that God had changed me from my same-sex attractions and given me personal freedom overcoming that temptation.
So
none of it was true, but that's what we said.
So how did you do that? How did you go about doing that? How did that make you feel? I mean, especially what time period was this when this was going on for you?
This was in the early 80s.
Okay. So in the early 80s, we had a lot of things going on in the gay community. The gay community needed a lot of support, as you know. So as somebody who was struggling with this decision and going around and being a spokesperson for an organization like this, how did that make you feel? Like, how did you come back from that?
The word that was used earlier, conflicted, that is it. I knew what I was taught to believe. I knew what I was told the Bible said about it. I knew what I felt inside, and everything that I'd ever experienced up to that point was these feelings of attraction toward other boys when I was 12. All of my early experiences were with other boys. But when I came into the Christian faith, I was immediately taught that was unacceptable. When I decided I wanted to pursue a career in the ministry, I got married because that's going to fix it. Mm-hmm. I was married for 19 years. We were taught to ignore the feelings. We were taught a message that we don't go on what we feel. We go on what God says in the Bible. So we have to say the same things that God says in the Bible. And this was in the early 80s again. So we didn't have the internet. We didn't have a lot of the resources that we have now. We lived in a bubble. And so when people told us this, we accepted it.
So what was that So I have two more questions for you before we move into the book. But what was that defining moment, that pivotal moment where you were like, I can't do this anymore? What happened?
There were a couple of the defining moments that kind of began to shape the foundations and my what I tell people, my ex-gay house of cards just began to crumble. The death of two dear friends, one by suicide, a dear friend that I went to seminary with, and after I left, he left early, came out, but we stayed in touch, stayed good friends, and he called me one day and was really struggling. His dad was a successful Southern Baptist pastor. He called me one day and we had company over and I said, you know, Russell, let me call you tomorrow. And he killed himself that night. And that shook me. And then one of the guys in our ex-gay ministry left and went, moved to another city. Contracted HIV. Came home after he went into AIDS, and I found out through a friend that he was back in our hometown and that he had AIDS and had not been given long to live. So I called his mother. I'm his pastor now. I'm pastor of a church. I'm his pastor, and I'm also the leader of the ministry that he's a part of. And I ask about him, and she goes into this horrific tirade that he is reaping the consequences of his actions. And I said, well, can I come by and pray for him? And she said, it's too late to pray for him. He will spend eternity in hell as a just reward for his actions. This is his mother.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just, I thought, we're doing something wrong here. Mm-hmm. And that was that. I remember that statement ringing in my head. We're doing something wrong. And so I just began to have these questions and doubts. And I had been at the same church for 11 years, very successful. And I was burned out and tired. And I think all of it just crashed in on me.
Let me just say that thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
That is so powerful. And sorry that you went through that.
My condolences to you. I mean, you lost a friend.
Yeah. For sure.
That's one of two friends I lost by suicide. And it's that one. Russell has been 30 something years and it still is very difficult, to think about. You know, I should have said something. I could have said something. What did I, you know, but, I did it. And so I live with that.
You know, It's crazy what religion and what we're brought up to assume makes us do in life and move forward with in our beliefs in life. And I wanted to ask you, are you still religious before we move into the book and how your views have changed? And if you are still religious, how do you now preach to individuals that are kind of contemplating the fact that religion is a tough thing,
right? Preach and practice.
It's tough. It can be very toxic in that environment, in the conservative fundamental environment that I was in and a part of. I try to talk about it. It's like a bubble, and inside that bubble, we're both we have this echo chamber, so we only hear what other people who believe like us say. But it also is an isolation chamber for us. We don't know what's going on outside. And we didn't have the ability to research back then. I still consider myself a person of faith. I have clearly abandoned most of the tenets that I was raised in as far as fundamentalism. I do not believe in a God that is judgmental, that is hateful, that is vindictive, petty, capricious. I do hold to a faith that has a lot more questions now than it has answers, mm-hmm. and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh my God. This conversation is going to be a lot more powerful than I thought.
Certainly very powerful.
sorry, guys.
No, you're fine. We love that. We love this stuff.
We need this. I mean, these are the kind of things that we need to hear, right? Because when we think about most of our youngsters, you know, when you think about what's happening in America right now, especially with our gay youth, we have people committing suicide. We have people taking
an alarming rate.
That's right, and all because of what's driving a lot of that is what parents believe and what society believes and what people say should be the norm, right? We're working on someone else's norms,
and systemically it's coming from the Catholic religion, to be honest. My opinion.
Well, of course, definitely with that, but also we've had people on the show who have been conflicted with their Mormon faith. We've had spoke with a lot of people out of Utah, Mama Dragons, Dragon Dads, Yasu, many different groups of people that really stood by their faith, but then when they were introduced or found out that someone in their own family was gay or all of their children were gay, that their life changed, and they realized there couldn't be a God as vindictive and capricious as you were saying.
Yes. Conservative religion, regardless of the tag, Catholicism, Baptist, fundamentalists, Pentecostals, Mormons, all of those, they have it could be Muslim, it could be Buddhism. When it's this extreme fundamentalism that everything is black and white. You don't get to think for yourself. You don't need to think for yourself because everything is told to you. It's cultic. It's very dangerous.
Absolutely.
And it creates shame, fear, and guilt. And that triad is what leads people to ultimately check out and say, I can't do this anymore. And suicide seems to be the answer for them. They think that's the answer.
Wow.
Well, I can tell you.
I work with a lot of LGBTQ people who have come out of a religious faith in one form or another, abandoning it completely or rethinking it, and especially those who have been through some form of conversion therapy. So I listen to the tragic horror stories.
So let's dive into this book because I mean the conversation is going to continue. So I'm gonna open this up with saying that this book is a fiction book, a drama, but I feel like not really fiction. I feel like it stems from something we may be talking about, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about the book and where it came from. And
okay, the book is. Autobiographical in the sense that my own experiences, it takes place in Birmingham, Alabama, which is my hometown. It takes place in the early 80s. My main character is on staff at a very conservative Christian church, and he is facing some of these issues. And so it's autobiographical in the sense that I created a world. And I place these characters in a world that I once inhabited. The main character is not me, but he experiences some of the things that I experienced. So it is in that sense, I think all fiction writers draw something from their own lives. This is my fourth novel, so my life is not always as interesting as my characters. But this one is probably the most personal. I've had people tell me for years that I should write an autobiography, but I'm way too introspective, and I feel like it would end up being dark like a Stephen King novel. So I thought if I could take my experiences and see them through the eyes of a fictional character, I could still get across some of the life lessons that I learned about conversion therapy, the futility of it, what motivates it, what drives it, the conflict that it causes, and maybe some possible answers for people who are considering it. So it is fiction. It's a fun story. Ultimately, it's the quest of one person to find their truth. And then at the very, very foundation, it's a love story.
It sounds like when you see those movies and they start, some say, you know, a true story based on a true story. We have inspired by a true story right here.
It is exactly. It is inspired by actual events, ripped from the headlines, if you will.
I would imagine that as an author, it would be easier to write a fictional story on characters that have experienced your same experiences in life when you've walked in those shoes. So when you're putting stuff to paper, when you're going through the writing process, was there ever a point in time when you're writing this book that you had to sort of kind of like step back and be like, I need a break?
Oh, regularly. There would be times that I don't mean to be hyperbolic here. There were a couple of occasions where I'm at my typewriter crying as my character is doing something and I'm wanting to scream, Nate, don't do that. It's got to go. It's not going to work. Stop. Make a different decision. And some of the experiences that happened were so fresh and raw after 30 years, because I've been out of conversion therapy for 30 years and have been speaking out for that long against conversion therapy. But there were times that it was very difficult. It was cathartic, but also very emotional.
I would imagine so. I mean, it's a very intense topic, right? When you think about religion is one of the most prolific subjects in the world, right? Every single country that we could ever think of has some sort of religious background and was founded on some sort of religious tenets that drive what their life is like, what their culture is like. When you think about some of the countries that exist today that have laws that are derived of scripture, you think of, for example, Sharia law, and you think of, for example, the Jewish people and how they look at, to the Quran for guidance on
Torah,
or excuse me, the Torah. When they look at the Torah as some sort of guidance towards what civil code and civil life should be like, right? They have an expectation of what people are supposed to behave like in public. When you look at people in the Middle East, for example, women having to be covered, not being exposed to any other man, for example, other than their husband. And so you start seeing where religion plays a very pivotal role in how civil law and civility develops in nations. It's concerning to think that, for example, in our community, we still have till this day, today, religious organizations that exist in the U.S. in a country in where marriage equality is the law of the land, that we still see this religious-driven agenda in persecuting people for just loving someone they want to love.
Yes.
And what is your take on that? You're married?
Well, yes, I am married. We have been together for 22 years. And we have been married for about just over two. After it became legal, then we checked into all the legalities and the procedures. My husband works for a nonprofit. So we wanted to make sure that, and we live in Texas, we wanted to make sure that we didn't get married one day and he get fired the next day.
Right.
Yep. So we looked into a lot of different aspects and then we got married. So, but our country was founded on religious principles, religious concepts. I mean, the movement across our country, Manifest Destiny, concepts of, you know, God has told us to take over this whole country. And so, and we're seeing it more in this conservative movement within the current ruling party to enact certain things that coincide with religious concepts. And so, you know, we're seeing it in dangerous proportions today in our country.
Especially also even in Texas with the, like, Save Chick-fil-A bill that was proposed, I don't believe passed, but the fact that working to be sure that legally people can discriminate against people in our own community, as like you said, get married one day, get fired the next day.
Yeah, and in Texas, that's a very big deal. The idea that We want what is being called a misnomer, religious freedom laws. And it's really not. It's a freedom to discriminate right. laws. Mm-hmm. But it's very big in Texas. It's got our current government elected, our governor, our lieutenant governor, and our attorney general, all were elected running on these platforms. Mm-hmm. So it's huge in Texas. And we live watching out for some of those things. We have a high rate of hate crime, especially against transgender women of color.
Absolutely. Here in Texas. Yeah.
It's Transgender Awareness Week. So,
I mean, we're coming up on the end of it, right? Transgender awareness. It's crazy to think that, you know, we are seeing a lot of this and even from within our own national government, when we think about our government passing or trying to reverse certain types of, you know, the executive orders that were enacted by a previous president to discriminate openly against members in our military that are transgender. It really sends a message to the people. And I would imagine, especially people in like states like Texas, where it's in the South, you know, that you have a lot of religious organizations that are really harping on this message and making sure that for whatever reason it survives.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary.
And it continues to feed into the guilt, the shame, the fear that we learn in church and that now is being reinforced in our government, in our culture, in our society. I mean, one of Donald Trump's biggest supporters is here in Dallas at First Baptist Church. So we get a lot of it. It's on the news here a lot. So there is an atmospheric reality of discrimination here in Texas, but I know we're not unique. It's, you know, I was born and raised in Alabama.
Right.
So,
our phone number is from there, by the way.
Yeah. I was a freshman in high school when forced desegregation was finally enacted. So the first time I ever went to class with a black student was my freshman year in high school.
That's insane.
And so, I saw the effects of civil rights and standing up for what you believe early in high school. I was editor of the school newspaper by my junior year, and that's when I first got involved in civil rights. As I listened to some of these students, these black students who were forced to come to a white school, as I listened to them tell their stories, I began to get my first vision of what it means to stand up for civil rights.
Wow, that's intense.
So. Let's get back to the book.
Yes.
No, we keep doing it. And honestly, though, I'm not surprised. I mean, this conversation is so rich and so important.
I know.
And
I just want to keep picking his brain.
We have it. We have this conversation on the show all the time, and I want to have you back and literally dive into religion and what it means and how to move forward as an LGBT plus individual in the religious, like.
And before we hang up today, I have a question for you. I'm not going to ask you now because we're going to talk about the book, but I have a question before we let you go today about one of our candidates for president. We'll talk about that.
All right. So
I just want to remind myself that I don't want to forget.
So we talked a little bit about the premise and the backstory of the book, but I was hoping you can give us a little bit more in-depth plot summary of the book and kind of give our listeners an idea of what it's about.
Okay. When we first meet my main character, Nate, it is January of 1982. He's returning to work after a leave of absence following the death of his wife, and he's kind of ready to get back to a familiar routine. He's on staff at an evangelical church. And so he's ready to get back to this routine that he's familiar with. But he has a chance meeting with an openly gay man whose name is Trey. And that kind of disrupts his plan for getting back to life as usual. And that's when we first realized that Nate has this secret, these desires that he's fought all of his life. But because of his religious faith, as well as his commitment to the ministry and his marriage, he's always been able to disregard or suppress those feelings. But he meets Trey. They begin as friends. They're playing racquetball together. They're working out together. But then their friendship begins to grow. And all of these constraints that Nate has had in his life for all of these years begin to melt away as his feelings for Trey begin to grow. And that freaks him out. And so because of these feelings, he enrolls in or begins attending a group that promises sexual orientation can be changed. And so his decision to get involved does bring about change, but it's not the kind of change that he expects. So ultimately, he's going to have to question the faith that he's always embraced and confront the desires that he's always hidden.
So that is such a beautiful premise for a book. I mean, when you think about, I grew up Catholic, right? And when I first started engaging in, well, let's be honest, homosexual activity, there was this shame. There was this scared shame. Every time you had an intimate moment or an intimate thought, there was this shame. And I just, when you speak about the book, I can just like hear what this individual is going through after losing his wife.
You can
feel it. Yeah. And trying a new thing and falling for somebody in a different way.
I think that it's not necessarily new. The feelings were always there, but it was just something he was trying to suppress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now he has an opportunity to confront his demons and jump in and say, okay, well, we're going to try this. And I know that I believe this is wrong, but, you know, what am I to do? This is what I need. This is what I want. This is, you know, and how do I fix this? Am I wrong? Is there something wrong with me? You know, it's like, it's, you can see the concoction of emotions that are playing out in this man in real time, right? He's conflicted. He's like, I want this, but I think this is wrong. I've been taught this is wrong, but I still want this. What do I do?
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. You know that, and those of us who have been married in our past life, opposite sex marriage, you know, we're able to, you know, I can't say I had a horrible marriage. I dearly adore my ex-wife. We have two wonderful children. And it wasn't that I felt it was wrong, but once I then was able as an adult to be with a man, the level of intimacy and connection was so different. And that's what Nate goes through. He realizes he has this connection with Trey that he never had with his wife, whom he loved. But then that's more of a conflict. It still goes against everything he's been taught.
If you don't mind, and I hope I'm not prying into your personal life a little bit more than I should.
No.
You mentioned you have two children. You were previously married. Obviously, you came from a religious background. Did your wife share that background?
Yes, she and I were in the ministry together. Okay. We co-pastored a church in Birmingham, in my hometown. It was a very successful church. We were on the articles written about us because we were one of the fastest growing churches in the state of Alabama at the time. So we were successful. We thought we were very happy. I mean, we were happy. I don't mean to in any way dismiss what we had. Mm-hmm. But I had my own issues. I had my own demons. And those were not her fault at all. They were my fault. They were because of who I am.
Of course, I don't mean to imply in any way that...
No, and you were not. I just want to make sure... But never in any way diminish her or what we had.
What I wanted to ask was, as a result of your history, right, of both being very religious and coming up in this environment, has that affected your relationship with her now and your children?
Yes. We have a cordial relationship now. She has met my husband. My kids refer to him as their stepdad. It took a long time for that. It took a lot of years. But, you know, like I said, I was married for 19 years, but my husband and I have now been together going on 23 years. So my kids almost know me more being with him than, because they were very young when my wife and I separated. Mm-hmm. So it took a long time because of their background, and my wife is still very involved in conservative Christianity. So my kids had that. And so it took a while. It took a lot of effort to build those relationships. But I think we have a good relationship with the kids now and our granddaughter.
That's fantastic.
I think I want to keep talking about the book, but really I want to talk about your life. So,
yeah, you're definitely coming back on.
So everybody needs to read this book, but I want to talk
on, guys, anytime.
But so I have a question. So when, where, I mean, and you can relate this to the book, you can relate it to yourself. I want you to relate it to yourself, but where did you find the strength and where did you find the community to come out and walk away from what you had built and build a new life? Like, I mean, there are so many people that listen to our show that have emailed us and said, I don't feel like I have a community, but when I listen to your show every week, I have a bit of that moment. I have a moment of community. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important, especially coming from the South, Alabama, from Texas, it is so important to be vocal, and you're coming from a very convoluted, complicated background. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, and let me say thank you for you guys that you are there for people, because, and it, I'm so excited that people today, as they begin to ask the questions that I asked 30 years ago, have places like this. They have the internet, they have some kind of community, but, I feel like my answer is going to pull the whole discussion down a minute. But when I walked away from my marriage, when I resigned my ministry and realized in myself, this is not working. I've spent 8 years of my life doing everything I was told to do, and I'm still gay. When I finally admitted that, in my life, in my mind, I was a complete failure. I'd lost my marriage. I'd lost my ministry, and the one thing that I wanted the most in life, to not be gay, hadn't happened. And I sat in a studio apartment where I was living at the time with a gun in my hand, and I was ready to end it all because I was a complete failure. And in that moment, I just remember screaming out, God, I'm done. And I cannot explain it without being just completely metaphysical, but within me, I felt this still small voice that said, but I'm not. And so I put the gun away and decided to find a way to rebuild my life. Not long after that, I was offered a job in Southern California. So I went to Southern California, and I was able to come out away from my family, away mm-hmm. from that ingrained culture where people knew me, and so it was a very freeing experience there.
Putting that gun away was without a doubt the best decision of your life.
I agree. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I understand how people can get to the point where that seems to be the only answer, and so I talk to people who are. I get emails, I get Facebook messages from people who are there. And I plead with them, you know, give it a night, give it one more day, mm-hmm. Because I remember when Russell called me and he didn't take another day.
Right.
And I remember doing that. And so just talk to somebody.
And you can, if you don't have a friend who maybe understands it, or someone that you don't, if you're not comfortable speaking to someone in your family or your friendships, you can always call the suicide prevention hotline. We've talked about this many times on mm-hmm. the show. You're never alone.
Yep.
Never alone. Even if you just want to call just to talk, they're there and they're there to help.
You can call me. Yeah. You can call Mama Kim.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Which reminds me. Which reminds me. You had an interview and you had said some words that really sort of kind of puts everything into perspective. I'm going to try to read them. You've got me all. I've got all kinds of emotions going.
I'm usually the crier.
Oh, so
me too. I am as well. Interview,
and in your press release, you included the following. You said that the truth is that coming out is not always as easy for those of us who are in restrictive communities of conservative religion. It would mean denying everything that we've been taught to believe, and going against the church that we've devoted our lives to or to serve. So we turn to programs that promise that we can, we must, and change our sexual orientation. God knows we tried, often with detrimental consequences to our emotional and spiritual and even our physical health. For us, coming out was, it wasn't easy, but it definitely had detours. That message in itself just really just puts everything into perspective, because it just shows, it speaks to the conflict, not only for the characters in the book, but now that we've gotten an opportunity to talk to you, it gives us an idea of the conflicts within you as a person, which is incredible. But you also decided to, in light of this, you noted that proceeds from the sales of A Double-Minded Man will be donated to the Trevor Project. Which I believe is incredible.
100% of the proceeds.
It's a wonderful organization. I'm
portion.
Sorry.
A portion.
So a portion of it would be going to this organization, which we have since the beginning of our show. We started broadcasting in 2016, in March of 2016. Hard to believe. We're going on 4 years.
God.
And this is one of the organizations.
Is this a good time to send that email?
I remember when you guys would be like, wait till you're 25 to me.
So first and foremost, thank you, because it is a very pivotal and important organization that helps countless youth and people to have a resource to go to when they have to have a conversation about the possibility of taking their life, because they don't feel comfortable in their own skin, because they don't feel comfortable in where they are in life. And so that is huge. I wanted to make sure that our listeners knew that, and I wanted to thank you for doing that.
It's something that means a lot to me, because I have lost friends and I was that close myself. And coming out is not easy. Being honest is never easy. Transparency is difficult. And so I will always try to communicate that message that there is hope. It may not be right in your circle of those people closest around you, but there is still hope. Somewhere. So call somebody, talk to somebody.
Right.
You're legitimate proof that, for lack of better term, it does get better.
Absolutely.
It absolutely does. And I would have never believed it then. But I wish there were time to tell you the steps in that story afterwards that are so important to me. And so groups like the Trevor Project are so dear to my heart, because we have too many people choosing to opt out right now, and we make it too hard for them with bullying and again the fear, the shame, and the guilt.
I mean, it's like we were talking about it earlier with that kid Jordan. I don't know if you saw that viral video of him slapping the kid in school.
Yes.
But no, I know we're laughing, but like the reality is it's you're right. Kids, it's the easiest thing they think is taking their lives. But if you stand up for yourself, there's so much more power in that. And if you stand up and say, this is who I am and I'm not backing down, there is so much more strength and future in really grounding yourself in who you are and how to move forward in life. I mean, clearly, I am the gayest bitch ever, and I love every minute of it.
That's right.
I love every minute of it, because there are so many people that just need to be embraced and loved and supported and uplifted, and I think that's what you're doing, and I think this book has so much potential to do that for people. And I was wondering, before we wrap this up and, you know, ask you where everybody can find the book, what are your hopes and dreams for this book? What do you want this to say to the community? What do you want this book to serve?
I do want it to provide some hope. I want somebody who is thinking about conversion therapy or ex-gay, I want them to maybe, I'm hoping that parents, the story, by being placed in a fictional setting, maybe that'll get through to somebody where me speaking to a group of people saying conversion therapy is bad. You cannot change sexual orientation. But maybe by reading a good story, and I think it's a very good story, The reviews on Amazon are really very encouraging to me. So maybe that will help some parent who is thinking about sending their kid, or maybe some kid. But again, it's just a story of somebody who gets to a place in their life where all the things they've been taught aren't working. And so whether you're gay, straight, bi, trans, we've all been there. It doesn't work anymore. Now what do I do? Mm-hmm.
That's a perfect segue, because I want to have one more question, because I know we've been talking your ear off and listening, but loving every minute of it, loving every minute of it. So up to date now, there are 18 states, 2 territories, and 61 counties or cities that have outlawed conversion therapy. And then there are multiple more that have legislation either introduced or pending, also Texas being one of the states with pending or introduced legislation. As someone who underwent conversion therapy and took place in these in a conservative Christian church, how does it make you feel every day when you wake up and you see another city, another county, another territory, another state putting in their books outlawing this failed this failed practice, which has been proven to not be possible?
It's very exciting that we, because I belong to an organization. I'm one of the founders of an organization of people like me who were in conversion therapy, and we were leaders. I was executive director, and some of our members were leaders for years. We're some of the early founders of what's now known as conversion therapy. I don't say that with any sense of pride. I just say it because we've been there. There's about 20 of us now that used to be in leadership. We represent probably about 100 years of experience. So we can say it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so we've been pushing for legislation like this for years, speaking out, writing letters, working with we worked with Southern Poverty Law Center and different organizations. So it's very exciting when cities and states and counties recognize this. Anytime this happens, it's always outlawed for minors. And so adults can still, you know, make the choice. But anytime this happens, I think it sends one more message, and maybe a parent who's thinking about it says, well, you know, this city or this state just outlawed it. I wonder what's wrong with it that they're doing this. Mm-hmm. So maybe it'll ask a question. The problem is, for me, is you can still get it, because most all ex-gay programs are religious-based. They're church-based. Mm-hmm. And these churches and these organizations are not affected by these laws. These laws don't impact a church or an organization, only clinical licensed therapist. So it changes in one sense, but in another sense, the beat goes on.
But Roy Cooper, governor of North Carolina, took it a little step further by making it illegal to fund, to have any funding going to these churches or institutions that are doing it.
Government funding, yes. And those are the things that we were pushing federal legislation before this administration. If you'd have asked me 4 years ago, I would tell you conversion therapy is a dying practice. Currently, we have a vice president who endorses conversion therapy. We have a ruling party that has it as one of their platforms, the practice of conversion therapy. So we've taken several steps backwards in it, but it is still, with the help of the internet, people are getting a little smarter about it.
That's amazing. Well, Bill, first and foremost, thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your evening to sit with us here on the show and talk about this amazing work that you've done, and also to talk about your personal experience in life. It's been very moving, to say the least. You had me over here like ready to just bawl my eyes out. But before we let you go, we have the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, running for president. He's an out gay man, and he's ready to take on the task of running and possibly becoming the nominee for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. His challenge is that he's gay, and we have a lot of religious organizations out there that may see this as an issue. What mm-hmm. do you think, in your personal experience, the mayor needs to do to ensure that he is successful in his bid for president?
I wish him all the best. I worked on a presidential campaign once, and I learned very quickly that is not for me. I have the greatest amount of respect for Mayor Pete, and have long before he announced his candidacy. I think he is handling himself in a way that just continues to amaze me. Mm-hmm. I think the bar is so low right now with this current administration that when you find somebody who can not just speak English, but speak so many different languages, and is so well educated and thoughtful and compassionate, he regularly brings me to tears.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So I have the greatest respect for him and continue to watch him. And yes, him being gay is going to be an issue with religious groups, just like the fact that he's religious is an issue with some of the gay groups that I read.
Yeah.
They don't want him talking about his faith. And I think there's going to be, I've seen that in my own life as a gay man of faith. I get conservative Christians who hate me for being gay, and I get some gay groups who have a problem with the fact that I still maintain a faith. So I understand that dichotomy, not on the national level that he gets it, but I think he's an incredible representation of the fact that you can live true to who you are, because I've tried living in denial of my sexual orientation, and I was miserable. And after I began to come out, I thought I have to live in denial of my faith, which was so important. And I was miserable. So once I came to the place where I could join the two together, I had peace.
And the reason why I pose that question to you, obviously, because you have a religious background. You understand how religion works. You were running a religious organization for such a long time. And I think that one of the issues that he's going to have is that, one, he needs to have the evangelical vote. He needs to have the
POC vote.
People of color. Obviously, and Baptist vote, and
in the South.
How does he communicate to them in a way that allows him to be him, but brings people on board and hopefully get this hateful person that we have in the White House out of there?
I think as he continues to do what he's doing, mm-hmm. just speak, point out who he is, and show the sharp contrast. I think all of our Democratic candidates continue to show the sharp contrast of who they are, what they believe, what they're presenting, as opposed to what we're seeing now. I think that's going to be the thing. And then ultimately, it's going to have to be those of us who don't want what we're seeing now to get out and vote. Because the evangelicals and the fundamentals, like Franklin Graham and some of those, are not going to vote for Mayor Pete. They're just not. But they're not going to vote for Kamala Harris either.
Right. Yeah.
So that can't be the focus. And so there has to be this is who we are as opposed to who they are.
That's right. Well,
thank you for that.
I think his biggest hurdle is going to be the fact that I'm not the first lady for him, to be honest, because
first gentleman.
Well, I mean, for me, it would be first lady.
Yeah, that's but true,
actually, but he could pass as both Trish,
exactly. Nick,
you know,
that's Chastin. The only reason I'm not going to vote for him, because I want to be the first lady, gentleman.
I absolutely, as much as I adore Mayor P, I love Chastin. I could listen to him. He just is so incredible to be thrust into this mm-hmm. position mm-hmm. and to handle it with the grace that he does.
Absolutely.
I love him.
They're both fantastic human beings.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Bill, once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
But before we let you go, we would like for you to plug yourself, tell people where they can find you, whether that's social media, do you have a website, where the book is being sold. Tell us all about it.
Okay. I have a website, BillPrickett.com. That's easy to remember if you can spell my last name. I have an active blog there. It's called Brain Bubble. And I write about whatever's bubbling up in my head at the time. Sometimes it's politics. Sometimes it's religion. The union of the two. I write about movies, music, just whatever's on my head at the time. And you can find where to get my books there. But they are available on Amazon, most all online sellers. And you can get it at your local bookstore. If they don't have it, you can tell them and they can order it. But it's getting some really good reviews, and it's been very, very exciting for me. I spoke a few weeks ago on National Coming Out Day, and my theme was sometimes coming out has detours. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the book is about. It's not always a straight line. It's rarely a straight line.
Wow.
Gaily forward. Well, Bill, once again, thank you so much for taking time of your evening, joining us on the show. I think that this has been one of the most incredible interviews that we've had on the show. Certainly a lot of shocking elements to it, a lot of emotional elements, and we thank you for it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. I listened to you guys when we first started talking. I went in, as a podcaster myself, I went in and started listening to some of your podcasts, so I would kind of be forearmed.
Smart man.
you never know. I've been interviewed by people, and it's like, having come from a journalism background, I like to know what I'm getting into.
Well, usually so, we get crazy the first half and serious in the second.
I've totally enjoyed listening to you and am thrilled and honored that you would have me.
Well, we're going to have you again.
Absolutely. It's been our pleasure. And listen, we won't take any more of your time. We obviously have to wrap up the show. It's been an incredible interview. Once again, thank you. Look for an email. This is our email person right here.
I'm not just the email person.
Well, okay. She's more than that. But
she also gets tequila.
That's right.
I do. I pick up the tequila as well.
Phil, thank you once again. And have yourself a wonderful evening. Salutations to your husband. Because I'm sure he's back there somewhere. And thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, ladies and gents, that was, of course, Bill Prickett. We're going to have all the information on his book on tonight's post. We'll make sure that we have all the information and the links and all that good stuff. Let me just mute channels here so that we can, you guys can go ahead and click and find out where you can find his work. He does have a couple of more books that he has written that are also available on BillPrickett.com, and make sure that you go and get it there.
And check out his blog, because I'm sure there's incredibly interesting stuff on there.
Brain Bubble!
I like it. I like it a lot.
So we've got a couple of more things that we need to discuss. Obviously, Mama Kim is one of them. Mama Kim's Minute and all that good stuff. So, Nick, are you ready?
I'm sort of ready, but I'm not ready because I didn't pull the stuff I usually pull this week. But we're going to try and make this happen.
So, but before we do, Mama Kim is doing something. She's doing something incredibly unique. We can't talk about it yet, but thank you for the little trinkets that you sent us. They're beautiful. They're gorgeous. I'm going to give the guys their own trinkets when we're done and wrapped up. They're upstairs.
Okay. I didn't see anything.
She's all looking, but she's like, always does amazing things. So you see this gay flag here that's on the corner. She actually made three of those.
Handmade.
For us. And she made Hans Hershey one when he came down from Sweden. And they're beautiful and they're amazing. So,
and she sent us that copy of The First Family with Pete and Chastain right there.
That's right.
Here it is, guys. I love that.
What I like
hasn't she done for us?
Okay? I love Mama Kim.
She's amazing.
She's collectively our mother, too.
No, literally, I talk to her all the time.
So, all right. So, Mama Kim's Minute. So, Christopher, do you have the timer? He does. Maybe he doesn't.
My phone's not. Okay, got it.
And
all right, everybody. Here you go. Here's Mama Kim's Minute.
Go.
All right, everybody. Here's Mama Kim's Minute. So, singer Ellie Goulden threatens to quit NFL halftime show because it supports the Salvation Army. Slap.
Slap.
Lil Nas X is the first out gay black person to win a country music award.
No slap.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes, that's my daughter, and she has short hair. She is not a boy. Leave her alone.
And then,
of course, as always, two gay penguins, gay dads, steal well, I don't want to say steal, but take over another egg.
They adopt an egg.
It's beautiful.
Sort of. Legally, not legally.
It's beautiful when you can see everything gay reflected in nature, right? Because we're not an abomination. We're here.
But can I just say that I think we have a theme going. People keep sending us penguin stories.
Because they're amazing. Animal stories.
Of course. True. And it's penguins are like the cutest freaking things. Like, come on, a bird that can't fly, that's adorable. That is adorable.
That's you.
Yeah. Like, all right. Are we moving on?
Yes. It's Trisha's turn again.
Gay talk term?
Well, all right. So your gay talk term, of course, brought to you by
GayRealEstate.com
is lips licensed to thrill. Play on words in movies where spies are licensed to kill. Experienced cocksucker. Lips licensed to kill. Thrill.
Oh my God.
Thrill.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
I mean, this book is every week. It's just
the gift that keeps on giving, except for the racist stuff. Other than that, we move on. So, on this day in gay history, brought to you, of course, by
GayRealEstate.com.
When November 18th, 2003, where in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts,
always
that's right, Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court rules in a 4-3 ruling that same-sex couples have the right to marry, making Massachusetts the first U.S. state to legalize same-sex marriage.
Did he say Massachusetts?
Did I say?
No, literally, Mama Kim texted me, so I missed it.
Okay, whatever. Massachusetts, Macachusetts, whatever you want to call it.
I want mac and cheese
the
now.
The court gives the legislature 180 days to prepare the way, and the state begins granting marriage licenses on May 17th of the year 2014. So, today in history, Mass became the first state or commonwealth to legalize same-sex marriage in this country. Yay, Mass!
Massachusetts.
I totally didn't.
I want mac and cheese now.
I want to pee, so can we like...
Yeah, I have to pee right, too, and so... I'm going first.
Oh, whoa, it's my turn. All right, guys, if you love the show, make sure that you go subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcasting service. By subscribing, you get the latest and greatest of our show and these two crazy ones delivered right to your favorite device or web browser as soon as our episodes are published. You can also support us on Patreon, which allows you, our listeners and viewers on Patreon, to experience the show live and in color and all this craziness. And we collect those donations every month. They can be in any denomination of a dollar or more. Chris.
Next week, we're very excited. We're going to be joined by Tony Artolino. He is the creator of the series Far, Far and Away. So that'll be a fun conversation.
So we were having a conversation off script before we started.
Remember, I have to pee.
Yep,
that's
same,
right.
Same.
And we were watching the video. And what was it that you used the video to describe? You described the video as...
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. Next week's guest and the video and...
Oh. I don't remember what I said,
it was cute, but anyway, it's super campy, but it's also cute and super gay, and this is why we're having them on our show.
Obviously.
They deserve it.
All right, so thank you to our guest, Bill Prickett, for joining us on today's show. You can get more information on this book and other works by the author by visiting www.billprickett.com, and that's Bill, PRICKETT.com.
That's right.
Queen.
Okay. Yes, we can.
Cool. We're going to put a rubber on it. We're going to take it off real quick because I got to pee, but then we're going to put that rubber right back on. Ladies and gentlemen, what?
We got to smack it out. Go.
He's slowing us down.
Ladies and gentlemen, as always, our show is available on our wait. I said way talk like gay talk. Yeah. On our website, gaytalk20.com, under show and episodes. It is also available as a free download on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher Radio.
Nick announces you can find us on social media, Facebook, Gay Talk 2.0, Instagram, Gay Talk 2.0, Twitter, at Gay Talk 20. You can email us at gaytalk2.0@gmail.com. Tom, take it away.
Quickly.
These two bitches have to pee, so just go to our website, click on the Contact Us tab. You have all the options there. You can also call us, 334-GAY-TALK. If you need that number, it is 334-429-8255. Don't forget, we stream live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can access that live stream on digitalstreamradio.com. Ladies and gents, that is our show. Let them go pee. Y'all have a good night.
Bye!
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gay Talk 2.0. Tune in next time for more dish. Wow, 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 wow.